Welcome to Discograffiti, the podcast that obsessively rates and curates the greatest music of all time before the 21st century renders that music obsolete. I say no way, not on our watch. I'm your host, Dave Gebro. And in this episode, we're going to be mourning the incredibly exceptional man we all know and love named David Crosby, along with our very special guest, original co-host Joe Kennedy. Coming up, we have Terry Kirkman and Jules Alexander from the Association rating their entire output, episode one of the John Landis tapes, and a four-part series about the least fortunate acts that played Woodstock called We Are Stardust, We Are Over, including episodes on Sweetwater, Burt Summer, the Keith Hartley Band, and Quill. So don't go anywhere when this episode's done. Subscribe. Here's a couple terrific ways to find out what's coming up round the bend. You can join our Facebook group, Discograffiti Soldiers of Sound. We're on Instagram and Twitter, too, in case you don't mess with the Zuck. Or you can write to info@discograffiti.com and sign up for our weekly email list. Lastly, the link to our legendary playlist is in the show notes and also on our website at discograffiti.com. So follow along with us chronologically as we eulogize and mourn the great, great loss of David Crosby to the music world and to the world at large. Tonight is going to be a break from our cherished format. There won't be any ratings, nor will there be any snarkiness projected at his obvious lesser works. Just marveling at the wonder that was this amazing human being as far as I'm concerned. Hi, Joe.
Hey, everybody. And Dave. What's up?
Wow.
I said hello to everybody else first.
That was a real punch in the nuts.
I'm polite like that. I'm really here for them, not you, motherfucker.
The pain of David's loss was now subsumed by your rejection. You know, as you know, I've been on the road headed from California to New Jersey to move with my wife and four-year-old. It happened on the way back to New Jersey. And in fact, on the way back, Jeff Beck died. And you and I were actually going to do an episode on Jeff Beck. But I have to be honest with you, Jeff Beck definitely had an impact on me. This is, for me, a huge loss.
I think this is kind of a more interesting conversation than Jeff Beck. As great as a guitarist as Jeff Beck was, you can kind of summarize what he does pretty quickly. And I think Crosby has a much more interesting kind of story to sort of tell. So yeah, I'm not, that's sad that he died, but I think we're getting a better episode out of it all.
That's what matters really at the end of the
and
day.
And hey, you know, David Crosby had a good, that guy lived to 81 years old. I mean, he's playing with house money for quite some time there. So
for a long time. And oddly, it's funny, you know, the more I think about it, you know, it's not a shocking death. It's the opposite of a shocking death, but it's also an incredibly shocking death because the guy seemed invulnerable.
Well, and also he was kind of still in the culture, sort of. He's kind of like a voice on Twitter, and he manages to get himself in the news fairly often by saying something kind of crusty and irascible. But there's something kind of still lovable about him, even in his crusty get off my lawn phase the last few years here. He's really had a great, is active on Twitter a lot and would, you know, say a lot of notable things. So it seemed like he was kind of with us, you know, he wasn't just kind of up in his mansion on the hill, not interacting with us at all. He was kind of still in our lives, you know?
Well, that was the whole thing. He didn't have a mansion on the hill. This guy was living kind of paycheck to paycheck, because if you're a junkie for as long as he was, you got a lot of catching up to do. And I think there was no way that he was ever going to catch up.
Right. But, you know, he did a lot of living in those 81 years. So, you know, it's the old, you know, he left it all on the field, you know?
He did. So we're taping the show 5 days after he passed away. It is just going to be sort of a summary of his greatest accomplishments. Mainly what we're going to do is detail the songs that he had a hand in writing. If he sang on it, we might touch on it, but if he wrote it, we're going to explore it possibly if it's if we feel it's worthy of mention. And the playlist on this one's going to be a real doozy. Crosby, to me, I think represents the most purest form of hedonism from the 60s, more than any other artist probably from that time. Even the ones that died of excess back in that day, somehow he sort of had a Peter Pan hedonism, whereas everyone else looked like they were just trying to kill themselves.
Right. He's at the center of so many of the scenes, kind of. I mean, he's definitely like one of the ultimate cool kids of the, you know, rock music business of that time. He's sort of everywhere. and is friends with everybody and just seems to know where the party is at all times. The key to understanding him is that he's kind of omnipresent around, you know, so much music that's happening at that time, even if he's not always central to it. It's kind of a paradox because he seems kind of difficult to get along with. Like, he has a lot of conflict everywhere he goes, but then his approach to music is that he's very much a team player kind of guy. So he manages to collaborate with people very well, despite his, you know, personality quirks.
I see a lot of myself in him, the charismatic asshole.
Right.
You know, to be totally honest with you, like, you know, the last 5 days, I've been reeling over this. It's good to see that it's not just me, but it's also cast in a, you know, very harsh light in my mind, just how miserable the upcoming 10 years are going to be. We're going to lose everybody.
Yeah, I mean, from that time, I guess.
Yeah, but is there any other era that matters?
Yeah, sure.
Oh.
All the punk rockers still got like 20 years or something left.
Yeah, well, they were sniffing glue, so maybe not. It'll be a brutal 10 years, I think.
The rest of our life is going to be shit. So you just should probably just accept that now. It's all downhill from here.
This seems to be the most severe indicator that that is an objective truth. So here is a section that we love to call the run-up. This will get us to his first release with a little bit of backstory. David Van Cortlandt Crosby was born in L.A., the second son of an Academy Award-winning cinematographer named Floyd Crosby, who worked on some big movies like High Noon, etc. And then his mom was a salesperson at Macy's named Aleph Van Cortlandt Whitehead, and she was descended from the prominent Van Cortlandt family and were regularly in the New York Society pages. It's worthy of note because it comes up later that David was had an older brother named Ethan. Crosby briefly studied drama at Santa Barbara City College. He dropped out to pursue a career in music, performing with the singer Terry Callier. So Terry Callier was like the first stop for him. He performed with Terry in Chicago and Greenwich Village. They didn't get a record contract. He also performed with Les Baxter's Balladeers around 62. The first big dude in his music career, Jim Dixon, with the help of him, he was a producer. Crosby recorded his first solo session in 1963. He got back to Chicago from New York City to hang out with Terry again. On tour and in Chicago at that time was Miriam Makeba and her band, who knew a guy named Jim McGuinn, who later dropped his first name and went by his middle name, Roger. Callier wound up introducing Crosby to McGuinn and to Gene Clark, who were both then performing under the name The Jet Set. They changed their name to The Birds. Crosby joined in 64. They had their first number one hit in 65 with Mr. Tambourine Man, but no writing by Crosby on that first record because he was really a voice. You know, Gene Clark was the guy.
Yeah, he doesn't even get a co-write on that first album. So no, he's not participating in that as of yet, even though he has written some kind of pretty good songs by this time that come out later.
Yeah, he's, you know, one thing that you find if you're a huge Crosby fan, and this is like whimsically amusing, yet kind of mildly infuriating if you're a fan, is that a lot of his key works were already written between 63 and 68.
Yeah, he kind of pulls from that as he's kind of making records. But he does have as we'll see as we go through this, I'm sure you'll mention that some of them were from this period. He already had some good tunes going. He's not a highly prolific songwriter. You know, he usually gets a few songs on a record. He did, you know, on the later records with Nash, he would have like, you know, half the record would be his. But especially in this time, he's really only getting a few songs on each record. Didn't have a huge backlog of stuff at this point.
Yeah. I mean, his first appearance on a record. And by the way, before we even get into the meat of The Birds, they're the first band that he was, or the first outfit that really, really blew me away, that really made an impression on me. As a kid of single digit ages, I was listening to The Birds all the time. And I'm not cool enough to say that I was listening to like Sweetheart of the Rodeo or something, but single digit ages, I was listening to the first Birds Greatest Hits record with great regularity. Not too long after that, discovering Notorious Bird Brothers, but his first appearance on a record was their second album, Turn, 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 with a co-write with McGuinn called Wait and See.
Right. Now, some of these co-writes, it's kind of hard to discern how much percentage of the pie he actually wrote. This right. Sounds kind of more like a McGuinn song to me.
It does.
Some of the other ones, Crosby has a certain kind of style of this like floaty, dreamy kind of drone-y style of writing that he often will do. And you can, some of the co-writes, you can really feel his fingerprints on more. Yeah. This one, it's kind of hard to say, but cool tune though. Sort of a minor trifle, but they're very birdsy already. This is very, you know, it's got the 12 string guitar and the signature sound birds song.
Yeah. And the chiminess is, like you said, much more reflective of McGuinn than Crosby.
Right.
And then around this time, don't know if you heard this, but, and this is like a weird kink in the story. So Crosby wrote a song called Stranger in a Strange Land. You can actually find it on the Turn, Turn, Turn bonus tracks as an instrumental outtake, because I don't think he ever actually laid the vocal on it. But he gave it to a duo named Blackburn and Snow, who were fantastic. They released the song as a late December 1966 single. The writing of the song was credited to Samuel F., but it was Crosby. The sad kink is that a couple weeks back, Jeff Blackburn died. Mm-hmm. And I tweeted the news to Crosby. I don't know if he got it, but I do know that he follows the show. He follows Discograffiti. So he probably got word that had happened. It's a great song.
I'll check it out. Actually,
yeah, that's a really cool tune.
But the thing that's on the Birds record is just the instrumental version.
You don't get any sense of what the song is from the Birds outtake.
Right.
The Blackburn and Snow version is fantastic. The revisionist history would like you to believe that Gene Clark left the Birds because of a fear of flying. But I think what happened was they were a bunch of young guys jockeying for position. And as terrible as it was that Gene Clark lasted so quickly in the band, him leaving allowed Crosby to come into his own. So Gene Clark leaves. Now we're in 1966. Fifth Dimension comes out, which, you know, is clearly a more psych-leaning record. And he's got his first solo song on a Birds record and a co-write with McGuinn. Both of them, I think, are great. I See You is the co-write.
Right, so I See You, to me, does have the Crosby fingerprint on it. It has that dreamy kind of open string, contemplative kind of style to it. The kind of thing that he excels at. That one seems to me like very Crosby-ish.
It does. It does. Anything minor key feels like it's got his grubby mitts all over it.
Right.
And then What's Happening? ! His first solo foray on a Birds record. And it's amusing. Like, I was listening to it today and I was laughing, you know, just in a sort of like guy smokes weed for the first time and writes lyrics kind of way.
Right. Yeah, it's cool. It's a cool song. It's an interesting tune. It's, you know, Fifth Dimension's a really good album, and it slots into the album just fine. It seems like it sits in there nicely. I know what you mean about the lyrics. It's there's some stuff from this period that's a little bit hippy dippy.
Oh, there's one coming up, and you know the one. You
know the there's a few. You know.
No, but this one is a legitimately good song. Although,
yeah, cool song though.
It's funny the way, you know, his music talked back to the lyrics at the end of every line, like.
Yeah, Fifth Dimension in general, I mean, most people listening to this podcast probably already know that record. If you don't, that's a good one for the full psych experience of the Birds.
But you got the germination of their country rock thing happening on there too. But, you know, not as major a work as what was coming up, because Fifth Dimension was kind of like, oh shit, what do we do now? Because Gene Clark left. Well, let's just latch on to psych and let's all start writing songs. So,
right.
You know, there was sort of a like scrambling together to find the way forward. And, you know, given that, it turned out fantastic.
Yeah.
Then Younger Than Yesterday, though, which is a whole different story. Crosby has got three solo writes on there and a co-write. The first one is a co-write with McGuinn called Renaissance Fair. It's not even 2 minutes. It's kind of got that Mysterioso thing he does so well.
Successful co-write, really solid song. Always a favorite of mine.
But then his first masterpiece, I think it's roundly considered the first song that he wrote that came out on a record that was like, whoa, is Everybody's Been Burned.
Yeah, that's great. That has the, like you were saying, that really has his style, that kind of meandering mood piece. You know, he'll use the technique a lot where he'll like pedal on a bass note. So the bass kind of stays on the same note and he's kind of changing floaty chords on top of the bass, oftentimes with like open tunings. That style of song often doesn't have a big hook to it. It's kind of more about the journey than the destination. But yeah, I love this song. Like, I feel like I'm back in 1960. Like smoking a doob at 10 a.m.
Well, the interesting thing about this tune is that it seems born from lived experience. But yeah. I don't know if you know this, that it was initially demoed in 63.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So it makes sense, though.
It does make sense because it's got a vibe of, you know, kind of being unto itself on an island stylistically.
Yeah.
You know, it's intriguing to me that he makes it sound like he'd been through the ringer and here he was singing about it when, in case of point, you know, he wrote it when he was really a kid.
Right, right. Seems a little bit ahead of its time for 63. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, totally.
It seems so of its time. A lot of times when you say a piece of music is of its time, it's kind of meant as a criticism of it. But I think this is of its time kind of in the best way. And it's kind of like harmony and style of playing. It kind of went extinct, you know, like it's kind of hard to recreate now. So I love the of its timeness of the song. It's like, that's what kind of gives it the transportive quality to me.
Although naturally contrarian, you know, I really do honestly believe that of the songs that he contributed to Younger Than Yesterday, this is the one that's least of its time. It's what it feels like to me. Renaissance Fair is very much a Stone 60s song. Mind Gardens we'll get to in a second. That's obviously, but Everybody's Been Burned has a timelessness about it, you know, that just kind of sings about the armor that you need to survive the world. But Mind Gardens, what a young man song. I mean, I love Mind Gardens just because it exists, but I was embarrassed. I kind of was like embarrassed listening to it for him when I was 13.
Yeah, I classify it as sort of a failed experiment. Yes. I guess that was kind of, he had to really fight to get it on the record. The other guys in the band hated it.
Probably had to fight for almost everything.
Yeah, I think this one in particular, he's a really stick to his guns kind of cat. Yeah. So it's like this long droney raga thing with like very kind of dippy lyrics. It's kind of very like flowery hippie stuff. You know, yeah, it's pretty dumb.
But it's great and terrible at the same time.
Yeah, you should hear it once. I probably just to check it out. It's something.
I've heard it so many times. It's not a boring listen.
Yeah, like I said, it's something.
Yeah. And then Why is fantastic. Why was the flip of 8 Miles High. There's two versions of it. Both are awesome. And he plays like a real, I believe that's him on rhythm guitar, playing like a really, like a sort of delicate swing to his playing.
Yeah, he's a good rhythm guitar player. There are a lot of these that I noticed I really liked his guitar playing on. You can kind of clearly, because McGuinn is such a clear stylist, you know which one is McGuinn and which one is Crosby on a lot of these, just because of their styles of playing. You know, his guitar playing is a lot like his singing. He's just a team player. He fits in there real well. He's got good feel, good ear.
Yeah. There's a couple of, if you get the Younger Than Yesterday CD or, you know, I'm sure you can stream that shit too. You got It Happens Each Day on there, which I always thought was a masterpiece, but it turns out he didn't really care for it, which I find astounding. I think It Happens Each Day. It's incredible to me that he never resuscitated that one.
Yeah, that one's in his kind of comfortable pocket. It's like another dreamy kind of like smoke a joint kind of song. You know, there's the pedaling bass and the floating chords. It's similar structurally to Everybody's Been Burned. It doesn't have quite the same magic to me, but I do like it. It's kind of almost always a winner when he writes in that style.
You know, a cool thing about that tune that is usually pretty controversial is that the whole thing was done except for some lead work, and he laid down a modern day lead that fits in perfectly. You would never know it was from now. Mm-hmm, usually yeah. You can, especially Exile on Main Street, you can tell it's like almost embarrassing. It's like old Mick next to new Mick. It doesn't work. And then around that time, he wrote what I believe could very well be his best song, or it's my favorite song, Lady Friend. It's just deliriously ecstatic. I think this was a bone of contention with the band. It was released as a single. It was not on a record, and it hit, I think it was number 83, which is insane.
Yeah, right. He kind of lorded over the recording of it, kind of like sort of took over the reins of arranging it and was very specific about what he wanted. And if you listen to the production, it's pretty lavish. It has the kind of big strings and it has like high production.
It's got the horn section breakdown. I mean, this is as Sgt. Peppery as he gets.
Yeah, I was going to say it's kind of like they're Good Vibrations or something.
Yeah.
Not quite at that level of sanity, but there is very ambitious. And I think it all really clicks too. It all really works. I'm surprised it wasn't a hit because it really is so good. I think they were kind of hoping this was going to be their kind of a big chart topper, and it just didn't really work out that way.
I think it's a perfect song. It's interesting to me because if this had been the hit that it deserved to be, maybe they would have kept him in the band after all.
It's also not the kind of song he generally writes. This sort of like very bright and shiny jangle. It's like the heaven of jangle music. He didn't really write in that style very much. I mean, he's very good at it. It's a solo write for him. It's not a co-write. He wrote it entirely. Great song.
Yeah, really good. So at this point in 67, he is, as far as I'm concerned, completely come into his own. And he was really feeling himself. And you can tell if you've seen, you know, the way he throws his big swinging dick around at the Monterey Pop Festival. Tensions were high with the Byrds at that point because his JFK assassination conspiracy theories as between song banter at the fest did not go over well with McGuinn and Hillman. So, and then to worsen the mood, Stephen Stills invited Crosby to sit in with Buffalo Springfield because Neil Young wasn't around. And so he's kicking the Byrds and the balls left and right at this point. To be totally fair, his JFK diatribes, I saw it once. It was astounding. It felt astoundingly annoying to me.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. It's almost like a modern day, like they like canceled him from the Byrds because he was because of that. That seemed to be a kind of a straw breaking the camel's back thing. That seemed to kind of be the beginning of the end.
It wasn't the straw. It was the beginning of the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
The straw is Notorious.
Yeah, I guess those are two different things. I guess it's where it started to take a left turn with him and the Byrds,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. This is like, I think, probably the first public, obvious left turn. So in late 67, they're recording what is clearly to me their best record that was born of outrageous contention, the Notorious Byrd Brothers, where his picture on the cover was replaced with a horse. I don't think they were a big fan of this guy at this point. There's no completely solo rights for him on the record, but everything that he put his hand to was fantastic. You had Draft Morning, which is an amazing song, a co-write with Hillman and McGuinn. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite Byrd songs ever, and it's got an early appearance of the Fire Sign Theater.
Also sounds very Crosby-ish to me.
Yeah, and it's got this real sad, melancholic droop to it that I always found very cozy. It's a very lived-in, cozy, you know, if you haven't experienced the Notorious Byrd Brothers, every song is crucial, but this is a key component. And then Tribal Gathering was a co-write with Hillman.
Great 5/4 groove on that.
Kind of spooky. And it's about the first human being, which went down in Joe and I's old neck of the woods in Golden Gate Park, January 14th, 1967. And then Dolphin Smile, which is a co-write with McGuinn and Hillman, which is stunning.
So yeah, so he doesn't really have any solo rights on this, but especially the two, Draft Morning and Dolphin Smile, seem like kind of mostly his songs. Seems like they're songs that are in his style the most. So you can almost count that they seem like Crosby songs to me. That's a pretty significant contribution to a really great record, even if he kind of did already have a foot out the door at this point.
But the straw that broke the camel's back was Triad/Going Back. He wrote a song called Triad, which, talk about of its time. It's a song about a threesome, a gentle, you know, loving song about a threesome.
Seems kind of innocuous, mostly, this sort of subject matter of it. It's not really, doesn't seem that shocking reading the lyrics now, but at the time, well, I guess.
He wound up having the last laugh because Jefferson Airplane did a killer version of it on Crown of Creation. And by the way, Lady Friend stalled out at 82.
Triad seems to work better sung from the female perspective. It seems like a more interesting song. I guess the Airplane version is just also kind of like a little bit more.
Masturbate too when Grace is singing it.
Yeah. Their version is, I think, a little bit better overall. Their arrangement of it and her vocal of it.
So it wasn't just that he was pushing for Triad. He also was demanding that they do not cover Goffin and King's Going Back. So, you know, this is a difficult one for me because Going Back is one of my favorite Byrd songs. It wasn't written by the guys, but it's a majestically great song. And frankly, I like it better than Triad. But, you know, what are you going to do? These are young men jockeying for position. They kicked him out of the band. Over the years, he took great glee in pointing out that they had told him, we're going to do much better without you. And then they slid into the toilet commercially while he soared into the heavens.
Yeah, you know, I could see both sides. I love Going Back too, and I would I'm definitely glad that's on the album instead of Triad, but I could see kind of his perspective. Going Back seems like an obvious attempt to try to recapture old glories when they were the kings of the radio and all that. You know, it seemed like definitely an attempt to try to get back on the charts, and I could see why he would take exception to that. The kind of person he is, it makes total sense.
I think it's nuts. I think they should have had both songs on the record.
Yeah, sure. What would you cut off, though?
I don't think you cut anything off. You just add
you could only fit so much on a record, though.
I mean, there's a couple songs that you could get out of there. You know, Triad, I think, is better than Get to You. I think Triad's better than, you know, like a couple songs on it.
I guess so. I guess I'm so used to the running order that it's hard to imagine taking one of those out.
And by the way, before we proceed, there's an incredible website called Albums That Never Were. And like immediately, hours after Crosby died, if you go up on that blog, an incredible audio engineer has created a version of the Notorious Byrd Brothers with all of the material that Crosby had written at that time included, as if he was never kicked out of the band, with a picture of him reinstated where the horse was. And it's really worth checking out. It's actually not as good a record as the one that came out, but it's worth checking out. Triad, you know, wound up having a healthy enough life. Jefferson Airplane, the 1997 re-release of Notorious Byrd Brothers has the Byrds version on it. And then on Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's Four-Way Street, there is a solo acoustic version. So it's not like the song never reached the light of day. So the several months following his dismissal from the Byrds, all kinds of stuff happened with the guy. For Crosby, it wound up being a huge thing with the money that he got from his Byrd settlement, and also with money from Peter Tork of the Monkees. Crosby purchased a 59-foot John Alden-designed boat named the Mayan. And this was a huge, huge influence on him.
He's really into boats.
He loves boats. He sold the boat in 2014, but he had sailed it thousands of miles in the Pacific and the Caribbean up to that point, and credited the boat with being probably his most important songwriting muse.
He even looks kind of like a nautical kind of guy.
You think?
The mustache. It's sort of a boat captain's mustache.
Yeah. Yeah,
I look at that guy and I'm like, that's a guy that probably likes boats. A lot of pictures of him on boats, a lot of like album cover imagery, videos that were done on boats.
Speaking of the mustache, it was during this time, I believe, that he cultivated that mustache. Certainly in 67. And man, talk about a guy who's stuck with a facial hair semblance. Jesus, he loves that mustache. You know, worthy of note, some of David's best known compositions were written on that ship, including Wooden Ships, The Lee Shore, Page 43, and Carry Me.
Even some of those are about boats.
So in March 68, he records a demo tape that I have. It's amazing. It's called Just Roll My Tape, with tons of stuff that would wind up on later records. In here, seminal stripped back acoustic versions. And during the same month, he met a recently unemployed Stephen Stills at a party at the home of Cass Elliot, of course, and the two started meeting informally and jamming together. Soon they were joined by Graham Nash, who left the Hollies to play with them. Before they actually became a real, you know, solid deal, David produced the first Joni Mitchell record. I love the first Joni record. I know there's a lot of contention about his production because what did he do? He like stuck the mic inside of a piano?
I don't really know about that. Don't know the inside deal about it. I know they dated. I know that they were romantically linked. And it was a very embarrassing breakup for him. Do you know about that story of how she broke up with him?
Yeah.
So I guess she had found out that he'd cheated on her. They had like a brief and tumultuous kind of fling right around this time. There was some party at some highfalutin. Somebody in the scene had a party. And she announces, I have a new song. And everyone gets excited. Oh, Joni's got a new song to sing. So they all are kind of sitting around hushed. And she starts singing the song that's an obvious breakup song about him. I forget which one it is. But she starts singing a song that's obviously about him, and she's obviously dumping him right there in front of all these people via the song. So yeah, they, again, another contentious relationship for Crosby. I kind of like the way that first Joni Mitchell record sounds, though. I don't really have an issue with
how it
sounds. I didn't know that it was that people didn't like it.
You know, on the box that came out recently, I think it's Archives Volume 2 for Joni. First album was revamped without all that insane amounts of reverb.
Yeah, so they have tools now to remove all that stuff.
So they basically removed his production.
I don't know. Does it sound better to you or worse?
Well, I'm so used to...
That's a thing, right?
And also, she was a dreamy, flowery waif on that first record. She later, or not that far in the future, changed her tack. But I believe the production works, and I like it.
Yeah, I never really had an issue with it.
It's very cloudy. It's very much an element of the thing. So then, CSN. Hey, lads and ladies, Dave Gebro here. I abandoned my career and moved my family 3,000 miles to be able to focus exclusively on Discog Graffiti. And so if you're like me, and enough is just never enough, then please visit patreon.com/discograffiti and become one of our Patreon soldiers of sound. Discog Graffiti is an entirely listener-supported show, and it's also intended to be a 3-times-a-week music deep dive experience. So do us both a favor and consider giving it a shot. Trust me, I'm working hard for the money, so hard for it, honey. There's the main show on Sunday, a Thursday wildcard episode, which is either an interview with that week's guest, or an offshoot show like Rock Cousteau and Queasy Listening. And then on Tuesdays, there's the humdinger of them all, Discog Graffiti's The Private Press with Paul Major. You got nothing to lose. If you don't dig it after a month, you're refunded. No questions asked. Once again, that's patreon.com/discograffiti. That first record, man, there was a time, like when I was 13, 14 years old, Crosby, Stills, and Nash were my favorite band. All I really knew were the first two records. And so far, it's interesting. I had kind of forgotten that he only had 3 songs on that first record. It was Guinevere, Wooden Ships, and Long Time Gone.
Right.
Let's talk about Guinevere first, because A, as far as alternate tunings go, this is could be my favorite alternate, like serious alternate tuning song.
Yeah, I was listening to it, kind of trying to deconstruct how they did it. It sounds like the two of them are playing guitar, possibly in different open tunings.
Do you know about the tuning he used for this and other songs? Because it's so, you know, Joni would refer to her tunings as chords of inquiry, like they're question marks. This feels that way too. What do you know, or, you know, what do you hear when you hear the tunings?
I don't know what specific tuning they used on this, but, you know, the point of open tuning, the thing you get out of it is that you get all the strings that are open that kind of create drone kind of notes that are different from what you normally get on a conventionally stringed guitar. So it kind of has it sounds kind of unfamiliar. You get all the shapes are all different.
It rings out and kind of seems to hang in the air.
Yeah. And depending on what the tuning is, it can have this very suspended sort of feeling, like you were saying. I don't know exactly what the tuning is on Guinevere, but all the voicings of all of the chords and the way they're playing is really beautiful.
It's a perfect song. Every time I hear it, I'm so moved again and again and again. It's such an emotionally moving song. He's talked about it being a composite of a whole bunch of different people. That's neither here nor there to me. It's a perfect song, I think. I never connected quite as much with Wooden Ships, which is a co-write with Paul Kantner and Stephen Stills,
right,
and Long Time Gone.
Long Time Gone, I don't really like. Wooden Ships is pretty cool. It's a pretty well-known song for him. I like his guitar playing on it. It has a good band feel to it. For what it is, I think it's held up pretty well over the years. It's kind of like another protest kind of song.
It's like, we're going to, you know, leave here and start a hippie utopia song.
I think it's supposed to be like after a nuclear holocaust or something. There's like people who are on these
Paul
boats
Kantner
or something. Right.
Paul Kantner always had the highfalutin sci-fi. it's not that I don't like Wooden Ships and Long Time Gone. I do like them. I don't like his rockin' stuff quite as much. I think as a balladeer, he's second to none. So his rockin' songs, like Almost Cut My Hair and things of that nature.
Yeah.
They're good, but they're not, they don't leave as strong an imprint on me.
Yeah. To me, Long Time Gone was always the weakest song on the entire record, the first CSN record.
Oh, I'd have to go with Lady of the Island.
Yeah, maybe those two. Those two are the weakest. But his two major compositions here are really kind of key centerpiece parts of what's a super classic record.
I love that first record. I really do.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's amazing. And also, you know, must be said about CSN, the blend, the vocal harmony blends that they achieve really is magic. They're obviously all three great singers. Crosby is kind of the thread that sort of ties the harmonies together.
They represented the hippie ideal, and they represented like the, you know, the downside of hedonism and excess, because
yeah, sure.
I mean, when you have two albums and then the third album is a greatest hits record, there's something rotten in the state of Denmark.
Yeah.
I mean, this must have been an insane time. I mean, the human mind and the central nervous system can only take so much excitement and so much trauma in one chunk of time. The CSN debut record is released May 29th, 1969. They win the Grammy for Best New Artist of 69. Neil Young joins the group for live appearances. Their second concert is at Woodstock. Then after Woodstock, a month later, his girlfriend Christine Hinton was killed in a car accident that famously exacerbates his hard drug usage. Then in December, they play Altamont. So in 6 months, all that stuff happens. You know, that's got to be a doozy of a flurry of events to try to process. But let's take them all one at a time. First of all, what a notion. I believe it was Still's idea to get Neil Young in the band so they could have guitar duels. But man, they had like this perfect thing going. Talk about upsetting the spinning plate.
Yeah. Obviously, he's right in their circle of people that they all know. He's one of the cool kids like them. You would think they would have kind of wanted to stick with the formula, right? That first record had so much massive success.
And magic. I mean, artistic integrity. And then, you know, Neil, I don't think Neil needed to be there. I think it should, you know, it certainly, they created a lot of great stuff together. And
he has some moments, you know, but yeah, the first one, I prefer the first record to Deja Vu.
Deja Vu is a great record. It's also a fucking mess. Here's why. The first record, it sounds like all the songs were written like all the guys together. It doesn't feel like three separate sensibilities. Deja Vu feels like four. It feels like the White Album.
Yeah, sure.
So Woodstock, you know, is fantastic.
Great performance at Woodstock. They're one of the highlights of the whole thing.
And Neil had just joined the band and insisted that he not be in the movie.
Oh, I didn't know that. Did not know that factoid.
Yeah. So by all accounts, Crosby was totally in love with this woman, Christine Hinton. I believe she was on her way to the vet with their cat and got into this this accident. And this was only days after they had moved from L.A. to San Francisco. Crosby apparently began abusing drugs very severely. And I guess you could tell because he's only contributing two songs to Deja Vu. Let's talk about Deja Vu. So Almost Cut My Hair. I love it as a concept. I never loved it as a song.
Yeah, it's another one of those where it's kind of from that 60s blues rock. It's like a rocker. And that one has not aged well to me.
No. You know, even like way back when I was listening to it, like in the 1980s, when I was a kid, you know, I always wanted it to be better because I saw the title. Every time I'd see the title, I'd be like, that's going to be a great song. And then it just didn't live up to it for me, especially because you put it up next to the title track. The title track is an absolute masterpiece.
The song Deja Vu, the title track, is another thing that's kind of, he didn't really work in that style exactly. It seems like kind of very British folk influence when it first kind of starts. Then it's this very complicated, like ambitious, it has all these tempo shifts and like all these different parts. It's like, it's a pretty epic 4 minute tune. Really great though.
So good. And just like Guinevere, every time I hear it, it kicks my ass. It's not like, you know, there's so many songs that if you've heard them a million times, you put them on and you're just like, you know, begging for there to be some kind of emotional epiphany to make you hear it as if for the first time again. And that's the cool thing with some of his best work always feels that way to me. I always get a first timer kind of a vibe to it.
Yeah, that's one of his most interesting and greatest songs. It's, like I said, very ambitious. Like there's so many things that seem to happen in that song, and he really pulls it off. It really all works.
So then I want to talk about the slow slide into his solo work. At the beginning of 1970, he briefly joined up with Jerry Garcia, Phil Lesh, and Mickey Hart, and they were known as David and the Dorks. And they made a live recording at the Matrix on December 15th, 1970. It's awesome. You know, he's sort of like, I'm guessing he's kind of leaning on friends for comfort and solace during what had to have been a very confusing time to both enjoy your success and be going through that kind of trauma. But it wound up sort of bleeding out into and reservoiring out into something called Pero, which I'm obsessed with. Pero is the Planet Earth Rock and Roll Orchestra. David kind of, you know, started taking a lot of time in the studio to work on a bunch of songs that I think most of them were already extant, but he had the guest list to end all guest lists. Can you think of any album that has a more amazing lineup?
Well, I guess he's living in San Fran at the time, right? So this is recorded there. It's recorded at Wally Heider Studios, now known as Hyde Street Studios. It's still there. And that was kind of the epicenter of the scene. And a lot of records from San Francisco bands at that time were made there. And it has a very like San Francisco kind of culture to it. You know, obviously, members of the Dead are on it. Santana.
Joni Mitchell. David Freiberg. You know, the whole Jefferson Airplane Nexus. His brother, Ethan, is on it. But the funniest part of it is like, you know, during the song Laughing, you get Joni Mitchell swooping in, singing In the Sun, and then she's gone. Every moment of this is so precious.
It feels very natural, this record. It doesn't really feel like they're working that hard on it, like in the best way. It just feels like they're all playing very naturally, and it's like it's not labored. At the time, I think it was, I know for sure it was dismissed as just a sort of wank off. I think people didn't really get it at the time.
I mean, Chris Gow gave it a D minus.
Now it seems like it has all sorts of fairy dust sprinkled on it, and it's revered as a classic. But that's when it really slipped through the cracks at the time. I think part of it is because of the way it starts off. I love the first two songs, but it really kicks into its true greatness around song number three. The first one, The Music Is Love, is kind of like a
That's a great song.
No, it's great. I like it, but I could see why a rock critic or something is like, oh, this is just hippie bullshit and wouldn't get it.
I love the second song. I mean, I honestly, the only song that it leaves me a little bit cold is What Are Their Names?
Yeah.
But even that one, it's not bad. It's just, it's very strident. But if you're a fan of this record, man, are you psyched, because there's hours of outtakes. I mean, hours upon hours.
Right.
All of it's good. You got all those people on it. They wander in and out of the studio. It's an absolutely staggering record. You know, strangely, in my research for it, I found out that in a 2010 list of the best albums ever, published by the Vatican City newspaper, it came in second to the Beatles' Revolver.
That's the weirdest. Like, why does the Vatican City newspaper have that list?
I have no idea. But
that's so, the strangest part of it to me.
Before we get into the album, let's talk about I'm just going to talk super quick, because Pero will definitely have its own episode. The Planet Earth Rock and Roll Orchestra was kind of born for this project and petered out in the mid-70s. There were a bunch of records that utilized all or some of this personnel. And so it's a pocket of music history that needs further delving into. So, you know, definitely stay tuned for that. Joe, let's talk about the record. The record is obviously marked by the confusion and trauma that was going on with him. But, you know, you already touched on those first two songs.
The first song especially is kind of meant, I think, kind of as an introduction. It's sort of like a little mantra they're sort of repeating. And
I love that song.
Yeah, it sets up the album really nice.
And then Cowboy Movie, admittedly very long, 8 minutes, but it's like the original version of Thrasher. Thrasher, mm-hmm. the Neil Young song, Rust Never Sleeps, is about CSN and, you know, sort of a metaphorical retelling. Cowboy Movie is about CSN.
Right. And this album really has a strong album feel to it, where it kind of settles into a groove and it has a sound and it has a feeling and everything kind of flows into the next thing and feels like it belongs there.
Mm-hmm.
I think a very comfortable kind of sense of playing. And I think it's because of the way they made it. Like you said, there's 10 million outtakes. It has a very not on the clock sort of feel. Great Jerry Garcia stuff all over the record.
Crosby had the great good fortune to be the recipient of Jerry Garcia's, you know, he started playing pedal steel around that time. Right. So, you know, on Teach Your Children, he plays very traditional style pedal steel, but especially on Laughing.
Yeah, he's playing atmospheric pedal steel.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because there's nothing I could point to and say it's like this or it's like that.
Yeah.
And if I don't have that, what the hell am I going to do? So track three is Time Will Pay Us High at about three. Couple things I want to say about this one. It's a great song.
Amazing.
And it's about him cruising high schools. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. Yeah. I guess that's the high part.
Yeah, high. And also at about three when the school lets out.
Okay. Yeah, I guess it's kind of double meaning.
Yeah. Also definitely worthy of note is that style of songwriting where he's just kind of scatting on top of an incredible open tune chord progression kind of starts here. And, you know, there's so many great, some of my favorite songs of his have no lyrics.
Getting back to the critical reaction to this record at the time, a lot of the comments were that the record seems kind of tossed off, you know, that they're just kind of wanking around. Chris Gow and also Lester Bangs kind of missed the point of the whole exercise. Yes, it does have that quality where it's off the cuff. But that's kind of the great part of it. That's a feature, not a bug of the album. You have this kind of these kind of musicians assembled. I just want to hear them play and stretch out. And it's all very pretty and it's all very tasteful, the way everything is played. And that's a great example. Time Will Pay Us High is more kind of a feeling than a song per se, but it's such a great feeling. You know,
I'm never not in the mood to hear it. And same with Laughing. Laughing is stunning. I can't say enough kindnesses about Laughing. It had been around for a while. There's CSN versions. He had recorded versions of it from years prior. Thankfully, this is the crucial version of it.
Yeah, it's the definitive version, definitely.
Then there's a co-write with Jerry Garcia, Phil Lesh, Michael Shreve from Santana, and Neil Young. That's What Are Their Names? You know, that one is sort of a strident protest song, but then we're back on, you know, cosmically heavenly, deliciously delirious Terra Firma with Traction in the Rain. When I first got this record, that was my go-to song. It's impossibly beautiful. What is being played on this? Is that a harp or a zither?
I know the sound you're talking about. I'm not exactly sure what that is.
Like it doesn't sound like, I don't think it's a guitar. It could be piano strings even that are, you know.
Yeah, it could be like some kind of treated piano or something.
Man, is this song beautiful. Actually, the entire rest of the side. I mean, Song with No Words, Tree with No Leaves, because one title is just not good enough. And then Orleans, whatever you want to call it, all really, really pretty. And then I'd swear there was somebody here. Crosby thinks that's the best piece of music he ever made, and there's no instruments on it. It's just an a cappella.
It's a cappella thing, right?
And he felt Christine Hinton's spirit in the studio and improvised a bunch of different lead lines, and it just worked.
Yeah, it's a nice ender. This record is, you know, very much all of a piece to me. I really love every song on it, pretty much.
It's perfect. I think it's one of the greatest albums of all time. If I'm going to sit down and actually think about it, which I'm currently sitting and I'm currently thinking, then I would say that Notorious Bird Brothers is my favorite album he was involved with, and this is number two. Not only does it remain in print, but there's a 50th anniversary re-release from last year. Yeah. Tons of stuff.
It reminds me a little bit of John the Wolf King. It's a record that was kind of like forgotten, and it has similar kind of lived-in sort of nature to it, kind of a very laid-back and leisurely kind of pace to it. Wasn't taken seriously at the time. I think of those two records together for some reason.
I'm guessing the reason why you do, at least the connection that I feel for myself, is that drug-inspired lethargy.
I think that's it.
You know what it is these guys, they're not experimenting anymore. Now they I think they're aware that they have a problem. So they're trying, I think, to make it ingrained into their lifestyle, that this is now being woven in. So yeah,
this is just what I do.
It's what I do now. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Right. We're no longer in what's happening territory, you know, from the birds. Now we're in slightly scary territory.
Yeah.
All right. That just about does it. Thanks for joining us. A heartfelt Discograffiti thanks goes out to our graphic designer, Todd Zimmer, my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Corbin Betleon, Joe Kennedy, of course, David Crosby, and the entire Patreon community. I love you, and the show wouldn't exist without you. And be sure to stay tuned, because this Tuesday brings upon us another incredible episode of Discograffiti's The Private Press with Paul Major, wherein you'll be introduced to a whole new world of music there's very little chance you've either heard or heard of before. Not to mention this Thursday's Wildcard episode. And then next Sunday, February 5th, mark your calendars, because we're coming at you with Cros Part 2, covering 1972 to the present. And so from now till then, stay gold, lads and ladies. It's Discograffiti.